and occasionally to burst into flames. In 457, for instance, after the distant emperor had ousted the disgraced Dioscorus and foisted a replacement on the Alexandrians, an indignant mob hacked down the wretched new patriarch in one of his own churches and paraded his mangled corpse in triumph through the streets. No mob like an Alexandrian mob for combining intellectual snobbery with a taste for atrocities. Nevertheless, in the sheer scale of hostility to Chalcedon, there was something new. Rarefied debates about the nature of the universe were no longer, as they had been in pagan times, the sole preserve of the metropolis. Across the whole vast expanse of Egypt, whether in the churches of obscure provincial towns or in monasteries out in the desert, few were those who doubted that Christ had only the single nature. Indeed, the province was so teeming with Monophysites that they increasingly came to be known simply as Copts, an abbreviation of the Greek word for Egyptians. At last, after centuries of scorning and exploiting its hinterland, Alexandria had come to speak for the whole of Egypt. The result was a display of mass disobedience fit to give even Justinian pause. Only in 536, buoyed by his successes in Italy, had he finally presumed to reprise the measure first attempted in 457, and impose his own choice of patriarch upon the recalcitrant Alexandrians, a step greeted by the Alexandrians themselves as the opening up of the pit of the abyss. Such hysteria was hardly surprising, for Justinian's nominee, a monk from the Delta by the name of Paul, had known better than to take for granted the obedience of his new flock. Rather than risk the fate of his hapless predecessor, he had opted instead to get his own blows in first, a policy that had served to confirm for the Alexandrians all their darkest suspicions of the Chalcedonian Church. Their new patriarch, even by the autocratic standards of his predecessors, verged on the psychopathic. Corrupt, brutal, and with a taste for spilling blood, so uninhibited was his thuggery that Justinian, after a couple of years, was prepared to acknowledge something startling, that he might perhaps have made a mistake. Paul was duly sacked. A new patriarch, a Syrian by the name of Zoilus, was dispatched from Constantinople as his replacement. The Alexandrians, scorning their new leader as both a foreigner and a Chalcedonian, but finding him otherwise inoffensive, opted simply to ignore him. So ended Justinian's project to reunite Egypt with the imperial church, amid inglorious compromise. As perhaps had always been inevitable, the Copts were simply too numerous, too distant, and too Monophysite to be brought to heel. Nor were these the only considerations weighing on Justinian's mind. It was no coincidence, surely, that the squalid episode of Paul's tenure in Alexandria coincided with a far more crowd-pleasing initiative. The closure, in an isolated Libyan oasis, of the very last functioning temple of Amun. This step, although clearly taken in accordance with the wishes of the heavens, was not wholly devoid of earthly calculation. For Justinian was keen to remind the Copts that he and they, despite their disagreements, were all of them lovers of Christ. Urgent, though it clearly was to secure the unity of the Church, it was no less urgent to ensure the continued loyalty of Egypt, and thereby to secure for the vast population of Constantinople and the soldiers of the Eastern Front the incomparable harvest sprung from the floodplains of the Nile. Every year, gliding downriver to Alexandria, great fleets of barges would bring hundreds upon thousands of tons of grain, and every year giant ships would then transport the precious cargo onwards to the capital. Alexandria might have been a marble-clad cosmopolis of lecture halls and churches, but she was no less an entrepot of warehouses, docks, and silos. Had she not been, the new Rome would long since have found the flesh shrinking off her bones. For Constantinople and all the region around it are fed, in the main, by Alexandria. Yet in the summer of 541, as the ghostly fleet of bronze ships appeared along the Mediterranean coast, it was becoming terrifyingly clear that death, too, as well as life, might be had from Egypt. In July, reports had reached Alexandria of an epidemic in the port of Pelusium, on the far eastern side of the Nile Delta, that had left the city a charnel house. Panic at this news, however, was unlikely to have been immediate, for sudden flare-ups of disease were common, and usually, by the grace of God which protects us, do not last long. The outbreak in Pelusium, however, had not abated. Instead, from coastal town to coastal town, it had begun to spread with lethal speed. Every time a bronze ship was spotted out on the nighttime waters, people on the shore would abruptly find themselves struck down by a fever, and then, touching their groins or their armpits or behind their ears, discover painful black swellings, bubones, as they were called in Greek, until finally, it might be, staggering out into the streets, they would fall and become a terrible and shocking spectacle for those who saw them, as their bellies were swollen and their mouths wide open, throwing up pus like torrents, their eyes inflamed and their hands stretched out upward and over the corpses that lay rotting on corners and in the porches of courtyards and in churches and everywhere with no one to bury them. And so the pestilence raged, and as it raged, it drew ever closer to Alexandria. By September, the first headaches, the first buboes, the first rattling expectorations of blood were being reported in the docks. Within days, the plague was general over the city and far beyond. Alexandria, ever the intellectual powerhouse, boasted the most prestigious medical schools in the world. But even the city's famous teaching specialists found themselves helpless before the spread of the mysterious pestilence, unable to diagnose it, still less prescribe any cure. The death rate rose inexorably, until many houses became completely destitute of human inhabitants. So putrid were the streets with piles of the dead, so thick with flies, so slippery underfoot with blood and melted flesh, that it was impossible to clear them. Those who dared to venture out into the fetid heat, whether to loot or simply to scavenge food, wore tags so that their families could be alerted to come and bury them should they too be overwhelmed by the plague while abroad. Unless, of course, as was entirely probable, their families had themselves been struck down in the meanwhile. Nor, the observant noted, was it only humans who were perishing of the epidemic. Animals, too, were succumbing. Why, even rats, swollen with buboes, were to be seen infected and dying. Week after week, the pestilence continued its scything progress. Then, finally, it began to subside, until at last, 4 months after its first appearance on the streets of Alexandria, the dying was largely done. Yet the plague, always moving forward and travelling at times favourable to it, was still far from spent. Traders from Egypt might sail as far afield as Britain, and those who had survived the pestilence still needed to make a living. In the spring of 542, as the storms of winter died down, the ships of Alexandria started to put out to sea, bearing with them their freights of merchandise, papyrus and linen, spices and medicines, glassware and exotic sweets. Pet birds, too, and even camels were sometimes transported. And then, of course, travelling as stowaways, there were always rats. On the rats were fleas, and in the fleas was Yersinia pestis, the deadly pathogen that, unknown to anyone, was spreading the plague. The science of bacteriology, it went without saying, lay immeasurably beyond the orbit of the scholarship of the age. Even the most brilliant of Alexandria's doctors did not think to associate the spread of a pandemic so lethal and unprecedented with anything so commonplace as a flea bite. The result was, as ships fanned out across the Mediterranean, that the pestilence too, invisible and unsuspected, continued on its deadly way. Sometimes it happened, in the midst of a voyage, that a vessel would be attacked so suddenly by the wrath of God, and to such devastating effect, that it would be left to drift aimlessly on the currents, manned by nothing but corpses, until it sank or ran aground. More commonly, a ship would dock in some distant port, and then, a day or two later, the first buboes would start to appear on the groins and armpits of the locals. And always, after beginning on the coast, the disease would then head on inland. In Constantinople, rumours of doom had been sweeping the city for months. Back in the autumn of 541, as Alexandria had been twisting upon the rack, a woman had fallen into a rapture and cried out to the Byzantines that death was arriving from the sea to swallow up the world. The following spring, with the first grain ships of the year looming off the Golden Horn, and granaries along the harbour front busily being filled, so mysterious apparitions began to be glimpsed. Whoever was touched by one of these phantoms would immediately fall sick. Within days, across the whole of Constantinople, thousands upon thousands were dying. At first, only the poor perished, but soon even the most exclusive quarters of the city were succumbing. Such was the lethal effect of the plague's spread that entire palaces might be transformed into sepulchres, their mosaic floors littered with corpses, senators and servants alike left as pus-streaked food for worms. Even in the imperial palace, in the bedchamber of the emperor himself, the burning mark of the plague was felt, for Justinian too fell ill. That he went on to recover was proof that the pestilence, though virulent, was not necessarily fatal, for there were some, a small minority, who did survive infection. Whether this was necessarily a blessing, however, was debatable, for what pleasure could there be in life if spouse and children, friends and kin, were all of them dead? Certainly, to those who lived through that summer in Constantinople, the entire city appeared condemned. The streets were empty of the living. No business of any kind was undertaken, save for the burying of corpses. The butcher's shop stood empty, the markets deserted, the baker's kilns unlit. So it was, in a city prodigiously full of good things to eat, that starvation ran riot. The pestilence, adding to all the manifold sufferings that it had already dealt, now trailed famine in its wake. To many of those who survived its passage, the plague appeared a calamity by which the whole of humanity came close to annihilation. An exaggeration? Perhaps. But then again, accurate figures were hard to come by. The imperial statisticians had tried to keep track of the death rate in the capital, but had fast been overwhelmed. In due course, confronted by the mounds of corpses in the streets, Justinian gave orders for them to be dumped at sea, and then, as the water turned into a soup of decomposing flesh, for vast pits to be dug on the far side of the Golden Horn. Within these, rows of bodies were laid, and then trodden upon by feet and trampled like spoiled grapes, so that further corpses, when they were hurled down from the rim of the pit, would sometimes vanish into the mulch. To those haunted by such a hellish vision, the entire world seemed to have become a winepress, in which countless multitudes were being crushed by the wrath of God. Even though the plague, by August 542, had finally spent itself in Constantinople, reports of its onward sweep across the rest of the empire and beyond did not diminish in horror. Asia Minor, too, it was reported, had been visited by the pestilence, and Jerusalem, and the rubble-strewn shanty town that was Antioch. By December, it was endemic in Sicily, and by 543, across much of Italy, Spain, and Gaul. That the West could boast no cities on the scale of those to be found in the East did not serve to spare it. In the most remote village, no less than in the darkest urban slum, the pestilence stalked down the living. The world seemed returned to its primordial silence, for no voices rose in the fields, no whistling was heard of shepherds. So it was reported of the Italian countryside. Places where men once lived had become lairs for savage beasts. Meanwhile, along the eastern frontier of Justinian's empire, where Khusrow had frantically constructed a cordon sanitaire, the plague was briefly halted in its tracks. One outbreak of buboes in the ranks of the Shah and Shah's own army had been effectively quarantined, and another in Media. But the pestilence could not be kept at bay for ever. By 545, it had breached the bulwarks of Iran Shah, and was sweeping eastwards with a violence even more terrible, if anything, than it had displayed on its westward course. Across Mesopotamia in particular, it raged for longer than it had ever done in Alexandria or Constantinople, so that all was famine, madness, and fury. Nothing was proof against it. Time would see it spread as far afield as China. Never before in history had so much of humanity been united by a common experience of suffering. If some communities were wiped out utterly by the plague, and some were mysteriously spared, then most, if reports are collated and the evidence carefully sifted, appear to have suffered a mortality rate of something around a third. Not annihilation, then, by any means, but a culling, nevertheless, on a wholly shattering scale. Always, however, after every visitation, the time would come when even the evil stench of the rotting corpses would lift, and people, rubbing their eyes, would emerge onto weed-covered streets or fields. Many of them, artisans, tradesmen, peasants, found the world they were returning to ripe with unanticipated opportunity. The ready supplies of labour that the wealthy had hitherto always taken for granted were suddenly at a premium. Demands that previously, before the coming of the plague, the poor would never have dared to push, were now increasingly theirs to make. Inflation, as a result, began to gallop. By 545, just 3 years after the departure of the plague from Constantinople, Justinian was appalled to discover that wages in the capital had more than doubled. The emperor's response to this unsettling state of affairs was his habitual one. He passed a law. By its terms, it was declared illegal for any labourer to be paid more than he would have received prior to the plague. The effect of this legislation, to Justinian's bafflement and indignation, was minimal. Wages continued to spiral upwards. The world, it seemed, was not to be restored to its former conditions simply on the say-so of an edict. And in truth, there was barely a sinew, barely a muscle of the great machine of imperial administration that had not been left enfeebled by the pestilence. Physicians noted with interest that those who had contracted the plague and survived would invariably bear the stamp of their brush with death. Some were left bald, others with a lisp, others with a staggering, lurching gait. Almost all suffered a terrible lassitude, often for years. To this rule, it was true, Justinian himself stood as a notable exception. But he knew, none better, that what might be true of individuals was true as well of his entire dominion. Infinitely more than the feckless tribes of the barbarians, more even than the kingdom of Khusrow, the empire of the Roman people had always depended on a sizable population for its healthy functioning. Civilian state that it essentially was, it could not hope to prosper without a hefty tax base. Now, in the wake of the plague, that tax base had suffered perhaps irreparable damage. Nor was that the limit of the danger. In provinces that only a few years previously had provided ready supplies of recruits for the imperial armies, whole villages, whole regions, now stood denuded. This, at the best of times, would have posed a formidable challenge. At a moment when Roman forces were engaged in a number of debilitating conflicts, from Italy to Syria, it threatened catastrophe. As for Justinian himself, so devastating and unexpected had been the blow to all his ambitions that he might well have been expected to buckle under it. But he did not. Instead, grimly, doggedly, heroically, he set to shoring up his battered empire against utter ruin. From the summer of 548 onwards, he would be forced to do so without the woman who for over 20 years had been the companion both of his bed and of his counsels. For, in June that year, Theodora died. Justinian, who for the rest of his life would never cease to light candles before the mausoleum which he had built to serve the pair of them as their final resting place, could not endure to take another wife. Henceforward, he would be married to his work. Day and night, for he had little need of sleep, he devoted himself to the thankless task of compensating for the most precipitous drop in revenue that any emperor had ever faced. Ruthless austerity measures were imposed, courier services slashed, road maintenance abandoned, the civil service streamlined. Tax collection was overtly professionalized, so as to throttle any prospect of evasion. Even the manufacture of silk was nationalized. Such measures won for Justinian, against all the odds, funding sufficient to bring his many wars to a seemingly satisfactory close. By the time of his death in 565, he had stabilized the eastern frontier by signing yet another eternal peace with Khusro, and decisively defeated the Ostrogoths in the west. He had even acquired a whole new province in southern Spain. Only fitting, then, it might have been thought, that the body of the great emperor, as it lay in state, had been covered by a pall on which he was shown trampling down a barbarian king, of the kind that it had always been the traditional prerogative of the Roman people to crush. Happy days, so the image proclaimed, were come again. But the pall told only part of the story. Its portrait of the emperor as the youthful and Christ-favoured visionary who, in the joyous year of 534, had sat in triumph over the Vandals, veiled the withered corpse of an 83-year-old man. Between the image of an empire restored to its ancient supremacy over most of the Mediterranean and the grim reality, there stretched a similarly yawning chasm. In the opinion of Justinian's critics, of whom, behind closed doors, there were many, the emperor's cure had proved quite as deadly as the disease. In Italy, for instance, no matter how shrilly his propagandists might seek to deny it, victory had left the peninsula immeasurably less Roman than it had ever been under Theodoric. Over the course of 2 decades, the bloody and wearisome slog to overthrow the Ostrogoths had witnessed the abolition of the consulship, the flight to Constantinople of almost every senator, and even, during the winter months of 550, the most shocking of all the breaks with the past, the complete, albeit temporary, depopulation of Rome itself. Not since the time of Romulus had the eternal city stood so empty, so abandoned to grass and swamps. Victory of such an order seemed scarcely different from defeat. Why, then, had Justinian waded through a whole mire of destruction to secure it? Because he was bloodthirsty and murderous by nature, some thought to whisper. That his reign had seen the entire world drenched with human blood was due not to his desperate struggle against evil circumstance, but to the startling fact that he had literally been an agent of hell. Even his tireless burning of the midnight oil might be interpreted as evidence, not of his devotion to the Roman people, but of his diabolic nature. One servant had reported seeing Justinian late at night without his head, another that the emperor's face had suddenly metamorphosed into a hideous and shapeless lump of flesh. How, then, could this man have been anything other than a demon? Admittedly, those who pushed this particular theory did tend to have axes to grind. Justinian, never popular with the traditional elite at the best of times, had hardly risen in their estimation by taking such strenuous measures in the years before his death to slash the budget deficit. Nothing about him quite so infernal in the opinion of stymied tax dodgers as what they bitterly dismissed as his avarice. Nevertheless, it was hardly necessary to believe that the imperial throne had genuinely been occupied by the Lord of Demons, to dread that the gates of hell might be yawning increasingly wide. Zoroastrian priests were not alone in warning their flocks that time itself was destined to come to an end, amid a titanic death struggle between good and evil. The same mood of mingled terror and hope that had inspired Mazdak to declare that the horizon was not far off, that the great climax of things was drawing near, had repeatedly haunted the imaginings of the Christian people too. Christ himself had warned his disciples what to expect. His own return, like lightning, that comes from the east and shines as far as the west. His sitting in judgment over the living and the dead. His delivery of the wicked to eternal punishment, and of the righteous to eternal life. And the day and hour of these events? Not even the angels themselves, so Christ had declared, could be sure of that. Nevertheless, certain clues, certain signs would herald for the faithful the coming of the day of judgment. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places. In the wake of Justinian's reign, this was a message as unsettling as any in Scripture. The plague, after its initial devastating eruption, had still not abated. By striking seemingly at random at different times and in different places, it cast a perpetual shadow of menace. Its recurrence, so a lawyer in Antioch recorded in numb despair, has seen me lose at various times several of my children, my wife, and many of my kin, not to mention numerous servants, both in town and in the country. Time would see him lose a grandson as well, a pattern of bereavement repeated across the empire and far beyond. Yet pestilence was only one of the harbingers of the end days to have afflicted the Roman people. Prior to the plague's appearance, back in 536, a mysterious dust cloud had cast the world into darkness for months. Then, in December 557, a terrible earthquake had shaken Constantinople, rocking it so severely that the dome of Hagia Sophia had collapsed the following spring, necessitating years of repairs. Most ominous of all, in 559, an army of barbarians had crossed the frozen Danube and struck so far south as to menace Greece and the capital itself. Constantinople had been preserved from seemingly inevitable ruin only by the desperate summoning of Belisarius out of retirement, for the aged general, frail though he had become, had lost none of his aptitude for winning victories. Elsewhere, however, the rising tempo of barbarian assaults had proved less easy to repulse. Bands of migratory peasants, known as Slavs, had been infiltrating the Balkans since the 540s, when the plague had first harrowed the region. Then, from beyond the Danube, a tribe of peculiarly brutal savages, stepland nomads named the Avars, had started to make alarming demands for danger money. Most demoralizing of all, perhaps, was the descent upon Italy in 568 of a shaven-headed, long-bearded people called the Lombards, who in next to no time had succeeded in dismembering Constantinople's hard-won mastery of the peninsula for good. Less than a decade after the death of Justinian, the imperial control had been pegged back to a corridor of land between Ravenna and Rome. So much blood. So much destruction, and all in vain. How were these catastrophic eruptions to be explained? On one level, the answer was very simple. Nomads, by and large, had proved immune to the reach of the plague. As a result, whether descending across the Danube or from the Alps, they usually vastly outnumbered the local garrisons. Even Belisarius, in his last-ditch defence of Constantinople, had been able to muster only a few hundred veterans, and had depended largely for his victory on a ragbag of peasants and plenty of bluff. Elsewhere, for all the conscientiousness with which Justinian had devoted his tax revenues to the construction of fortresses along the empire's frontiers, not even the most bristling of walls could be made serviceable without soldiers to man them. Time and again, as barbarian horsemen advanced into Roman territory, they would find themselves passing fields that stood overgrown, and villages that lay abandoned. Whole stretches of the empire, to all intents and purposes, were now deserted. All of this had long been foretold. Christ had not been alone in warning of how the world was destined to end. Jewish prophets and Christian saints alike had predicted that fearsome and savage hordes would descend on God's people like a cloud covering the land in the run-up to the end days, hordes of whom in the Bible had been given the sinister names Gog and Magog. The hint of dark mystery in all this had been sufficient, as the world had become increasingly Christian and barbarians ever more of a threat, to prompt much heated speculation. Who were Gog and Magog? Where were they lurking? Why would they not materialize until the end of time? The answers to these questions had been found, somewhat unexpectedly, in the biography of Alexander the Great. Historians had long known that the famous conqueror, in the course of his global travels, had discovered a mountain pass on the edge of the world which he had sealed with iron gates. Over the centuries, this story had been much improved. By the time of Justinian, it was known for a fact that the gates had been faced with bronze, that the peoples they had served to imprison had been none other than Gog and Magog, and that Alexander, upon whom the Spirit of the Lord rested, had built them with the direct encouragement of an angel. To the Christian people of Alexandria, this was not wholly bad news, perhaps. It provided a welcome reassurance that the founder of their city, despite his regrettable taste for sporting the horns of a pagan demon, had all along been a self-proclaimed servant of God. By and large, however, the implications were unnerving in the extreme. It was hard, with barbarians gathering outside the walls of Constantinople and the whole world seemingly on the move, to avoid the obvious conclusion that yet another portent of the end days had arrived upon the scene. The bolts set on Alexander's gates, so many dreaded, were starting to crumple and buckle and give. Beyond them, straining to be released upon the world, were waiting Gog and Magog, fiends so terrible that they thought nothing of drinking the blood of babies and snacking on kittens. Before the onset of such invaders, then, who could say what the fate of the world would be? No wonder, in the final years of the 6th Christian century, that many in the empire of the Romans should have looked to the future with a peculiar foreboding. Calamities are approaching, such as the current generation cannot imagine. A sobering reflection that the worst might be yet to come. The Great War. Around Easter AD 600, the plague returned to Galilee. So virulently did the outbreak rage that it had soon spread beyond the Golan Heights and into the wilderness of scrub and sand that bordered Palestine. Prominent among the frontier settlements devastated by its coming was Jabea, the great tent city of the Ghassanids. There the horror of the pestilence would long be remembered. Like whirlwinds, wrote one of their poets, it left the smoke of its blazing passage. Arabs who lived beyond the frontiers of the empire had previously been spared the worst of the plague. Infection stalked the desert less readily than it did streets or fields. More than half a century had passed since the first appearances of the pestilence, and still the Arabs took for granted that it was a disease of the land of the Romans. To the Ghassanids, and to the Lakhmids as well, the culling of peoples along the entire sweep of the Fertile Crescent had spelled considerable opportunity, for the exhaustion and impoverishment of both their respective sponsors had inevitably resulted in a certain loosening of leashes. Back in the 540s, for instance, at the height of the devastation wrought by the pestilence, Aretas and Mundhir had been free to escalate their vendetta without reference to either the Romans or the Persians. Superpower patronage, amid the swirl of their own venomous hatred, became almost an irrelevance. The two sides increasingly battled in the names of heavenly rather than earthly sponsors. Mundhir, following his capture of one of Aretas's sons, did not hesitate to top his earlier sacrifice of 400 virgins to Al-Uzza by offering up the Ghassanid prince to the goddess Al-Uzza. Other Christian captives, so it was claimed, were tortured by the Lakhmid king until they agreed to join in her worship. News of these atrocities, brought to St. Simeon on his pillar, so appalled the Stylite that he promptly lent his prayers to the Ghassanids. Sure enough, in 554, Aretas had been graced with a stunning and climactic triumph. In a great battle fought at Chalcis in Syria, a Lakhmid invasion force was annihilated. Simeon, borne from his pillar by the agency of the heavens to a hill overlooking the action, made his own personal contribution to the victory by asking the Holy Spirit to strike down Mundhir with a fireball, a request which the Holy Spirit obligingly met. Aretas hailed the Ghassanid dead, among them his own eldest son, not merely as heroes, but as martyrs in the cause of Christ. Here, in this notion that killing might be done as a service to the heavens as well as to secure plunder, was an intoxicating new possibility for the Arabs to contemplate. To the Ghassanids in particular, it had fast become something more, the irreducible core of their identity. By 600 there could be no doubting their commitment to the image they had of themselves, as the shields of a Christian empire. Not even a host of insults from the increasingly twitchy Roman establishment, including in 582 the exiling of their king to Sicily and a brief disastrous attempt to dissolve their federation altogether, could shake their loyalty. In their own opinion, they were warriors of God, or they were nothing. It was a potent conceit. Other Arab tribes, rather than dismissing the Ghassanids as Roman stool pigeons, increasingly viewed them as they had previously viewed the Lakhmids, as cynosures of chivalry. So open was the table at the Ghassanid court, poets claimed, that Jabiya's watchdogs had quite fallen out of the habit of barking at strangers. Even their recipes were of a quality appropriate to favourites of the heavens. No higher compliment could possibly be paid to a woman, for instance, than to compare her excellence to that of the local speciality, the Taridat Ghassan, a stew of brains and gravy. The Ghassanids' influence ran far deeper than haute cuisine, though. Their aura of glamour and invincibility served as invaluable marketing for their celestial patron, too. By 600, even the king of the Lakhmids had become a Christian. In Hira, as in Jabiya, stone churches were erected amid the tents. From the north to the distant south, where Najran's Kaaba preserved the glorious memory of the city's martyrs, the margins of Arabia increasingly bore the physical signs of the Christian faith. To ambitious warlords, these promise not merely heavenly salvation in the hereafter, but ready access within their lifetimes to the dimension of the angelic. The conviction that a man of exceptional holiness, by virtue of his sufferings, might come to see through the veil of his tears the blaze of the heavenly hosts, their drawn swords flickering with fire, was held by many Arabs with a wolfish literalness. The military potential of a saint, after all, had been amply demonstrated by the fireball that had incinerated Mundhir. Many warriors, in the wake of their great victory at Chalcis, had duly flocked to St. Simeon's pillar, as though to be touched themselves with something of his power. Decades later, the Ghassanids continued to see in their own Christian piety a weapon more prodigious by far than any other in their armoury. A perspective fit to awe even those tribes that had not submitted to baptism. Between the belief of Christians in an unseen realm of spirits and that of the Arabs, there was considerable overlap. Pagans, as well as monks, might claim to see angels. Dushara, for instance, was said by his worshippers to employ a particularly potent one as his lieutenant, while at Mamre, according to Sozomen, the draw for pagan pilgrims was precisely that angels had appeared there to men. All this, though, to fretful Christians was anything but reassuring. That a pagan might be familiar with angels implied that some of them, at the very least, must in truth have derived from hell. The full, alarming implications of this were best illustrated by what had happened in a city on the edge of Palestine, where, at the height of the plague, demons in the form of angels had appeared to the terrified inhabitants and told them that they would be spared only if they worshipped a bronze idol. Clearly, then, when dealing with supernatural messengers, it was essential to be alert to the possibility of disinformation. Yet this in turn, ironically enough, was nothing with which the pagans of the desert would have disagreed. Just as it was possible for them to accept the existence of angels, so also did they dread the malignity of jinn, invisible spirits spread of fire, many of whom took an active pleasure in the sufferings of mortals. Even the Ghassanids had blamed the onset of the plague on their stinging. A Christian Arab, picturing combatants engaged upon a celestial battlefield, would doubtless have imagined very little to perplex his pagan counterpart. Between jinn and demons, it appeared, the boundaries were easily blurred. And between goddesses and angels, too. Very possibly. Messengers from heaven appeared to have a definite preference for matching image to audience. Angels who manifested themselves in a Roman province, for instance, were as like as not to sport the medallions and bright crimson belts of imperial bureaucrats. Perhaps, then, in those reaches of Arabia, as yet only semi-illumined by the blaze of Christ, it was only to be expected that they would adopt the look, and sometimes even the names, of pagan deities. Suspended as a goddess, such as Al-Uzzur was, in an eerie, distorting half-light, midway between the past and the future, between paganism and the worship of a single god, who was to say what her future would be, whether as demon or as angel, or to be forgotten altogether? Certainly, in the decades that followed the onset of the plague, there could be little doubt that the border zone beyond the Holy Land was indeed extending ever further south into Arabia. That this was so reflected not the strength of the Christian empire, however, but its debilitation. A pronounced shift had occurred in the balance of power, not just in the region of the Fertile Crescent, but along the entire southern frontier. In Carthage, for instance, fretful commentators noted that, while the empire's once countless military units had dwindled in number, the plague, that ally of war, had not so much as touched the rancorous tribes. It was as a consequence of this that the Berbers, natives of North Africa, who lurked in the mountains beyond the reach of any imperial strike force, had begun to change from a nuisance to a threat. In Arabia, too, the desert nomads, spared the devastation of the pestilence, scented opportunity in the Romans' agony. They may have lacked the teeming numbers of the Slavs or the Avars, but they too were increasingly on the move. By 600, entire populations of emigrants, Muhajirun in Arabic, had settled between Palestine and the Hejaz, the region of Arabia that abuts the upper half of the Red Sea. Tribes completely unknown to the imperial authorities only a few decades earlier, the Judham, the Amila, and the Bali, now joined the roster of Foederati. Whether they were truly to be reckoned as friends of the Roman people, however, or as troublesome intruders bought off with danger money, was not altogether clear. Bluff, even at the best of times, worked best without an excess of scrutiny. Indisputable, however, was the fact that the authorities in Palestine did need allies to patrol a buffer zone for them. The same collapse in manpower and revenues as had afflicted the northern and western fronts had resulted in particularly devastating cuts along the frontier of the Holy Land. Indeed, ever since the arrival of the plague, it had effectively been demobilized. Forts stood abandoned to weeds, jackals, and the odd ascetic. A radical streamlining, but informed, nevertheless, by a certain brutal logic. Predatory nomads might be a nuisance, but they scarcely compared in terms of menace with the House of Sasan. 60 years after Khusro had plundered the cities of Syria, the frontier with Iran Shah remained Roman strategists' supreme priority, and the source of all their nightmares. Such resources as the empire could muster continued to be lavished on its garrisons. The consequence was, at a time when even the previously booming cities of Syria were afflicted by contraction and impoverishment, that the border zone with Iran Shah alone defied recession. And here, for those Arabs beyond the frontier keen to better themselves, was yet further scope for battening onto Roman gold. Not since the collapse of the spice trade had business conditions been more in their favour. It was not only Syria's cities, but its countryside that had been devastated by the plague. Repeated outbreaks had crippled agricultural production. Passers-by, observing the overgrown fields, the rotting apples and grapes, the feral cattle, sheep and goats, were moved to quote the words of the prophet Isaiah, "The earth shall be laid utterly waste, and be utterly despoiled." Yet garrisons, of course, still needed food for their messes, provender for their horses and pack animals, leather for their armour, shields and tents. Under normal circumstances, the costs of overland transport would hardly have made it worth the while of Arab merchants to trade in such basic commodities. But circumstances, in the wake of the plague, were very far from normal. The Arabs, for the first time in many centuries, found themselves major players in a seller's market. Nor was it only the Romans who offered them ripe opportunity for doing business. The same pestilence that had so devastated Syria had brought ruin to Mesopotamia as well. Formidable though the Persians continued to appear when viewed from the watchtowers of Dara, the truth was that they too, no less than their western rivals, had found the legacy of the plague a devastating one. Khusro's successes, no less than Justinian's, appeared to have left his empire only the more exposed. In 557, in the greatest triumph of his reign, he had succeeded in annihilating the Hephthalites once and for all, so that of the people who had once brought such ruin and humiliation upon Iran Shah, nothing had remained but the memory of their name. Yet that victory had come at high cost. The battle had been won in alliance with the Turks, an ugly, insolent, broad-faced, eyelashless mob. These new arrivals, gorging themselves on their winnings, had soon established themselves as a presence on Iran Shah's northern frontier, no less menacing than the Hephthalites had ever been. Nomadic, and therefore largely unaffected by the plague, they were even more numerous than the Avars, whose Khan they imperiously dismissed as a runaway slave. Khusro, pressured from the north by the Turks and along the western front, as ever, by the Romans, had duly found himself locked into a struggle to defend his borders no less desperate than the one faced by Justinian. Still, into his 9th decade, he had been obliged to remain upon the campaign trail. By the time he finally died in 579, he had, so it was reliably reported, lost his appetite for war. The challenge of how to cope with the escalating crisis was inherited by his son, Hormizd. The solution, attempted by the new Shahanshah, who would long be remembered for his benevolence toward the weak and destitute, was to accuse the Parthian nobility of hoarding wealth that could better be spent by himself on succouring his needy people, and to aim, as not even Khusro had dared to do, at the permanent breaking of their power. There was, of course, in this attempt at increased centralization, more than an echo of the policies adopted by Justinian in the wake of the plague. But the Parthian nobility, unlike their Roman counterparts, had never been content merely to snipe and moan from the sidelines. In 590, the leader of the Miran, a renowned general by the name of Bahram Chobin, suffered a minor reverse at the hands of the Romans, and was sent an outfit of women's clothes to wear by a contemptuous hormidst. Such, at any rate, was the story later told, and whether true or not, it's certain that the onset of the campaigning season saw Bahram Chobin marching not against the Romans, but directly on Ctesiphon. The news of his approach was sufficient to inspire two other Parthian dynasts in the capital to stage a coup. Hormidst was toppled, blinded, and put to death, all in brisk succession. His young son was thrust onto the throne and proclaimed Khusro II. Not since the dark days following the death of Peroz 100 years previously had the house of Sasan appeared more beleaguered. And worse was to come. Bahram Chobin went further than even his most audacious ancestors had done. Rather than rest content with the toppling of Hormidst, he took the ultimate, the blasphemous step. He declared himself king. Here, for the Zoroastrian church, as much as for the house of Sasan, was a manoeuvre that threatened the breaking of the universe itself. For how could the one hope to survive without the other? Bahram Chobin, it seems, did not shrink from answering this question in the boldest terms imaginable. He was, so he declared, the living embodiment of the fire of Mir is great. If it were true, as seemed entirely probable, that the end days were approaching, then clearly Iran Shah needed not so much a king as a saviour. This mimicking the strategy of Mazdak was precisely what Bahram Chobin claimed to be. Far from ducking the Maobed's charge that his rebellion threatened the end of the world, he seems openly to have revelled in the fact. In the event, his occupation of the throne of Ardashir lasted no more than a year. Khusro II, with the inevitable backing of the Miran's rival Parthian dynasts, and the far more unexpected support of the new Caesar, Morris, defeated the rebel Shahanshah, who promptly fled to the Turks. There, soon afterwards, he was assassinated by Sasanian agents. Order, it appeared, had been restored to heaven and earth. Yet this would prove to be a spectacular delusion. In truth, the presentiment of Bahram Chobin that the framework of things stood upon the brink of dissolution was to prove all too justified. Like the plague, the contagion of violence initiated by his rebellion was destined to spread far and wide. As in Ctesiphon, so in Constantinople, its effects would be cataclysmic. Morris, in his decision to override the advice of the Senate and lend his backing to the House of Sasan, had been influenced by one prime consideration: the urgent need to save money. The gambit had initially appeared a great success. The restoration of a grateful Khusro II to his throne had indeed resulted in a peace dividend. Fatefully, though, this had encouraged in Morris a terminal delusion, that he could now afford to stint on the pay of his soldiers. Back in 588, the army of the East, used as it was to lavish subsidy, had already mutinied over the issue. When the high command had sought to intimidate the fractious soldiery into submission by unveiling before their gaze the self-portrait of Christ from Edessa, the mob, far from being brought to its senses, had gone so far as to pelt the ineffable object with stones. More than a decade later, in 602, it was the turn of the soldiers in the Balkans to explode into open insurrection. Phocas, their leader, and a man quite as contemptuous of proprieties as Bahram Chobin had been, opted to do what no Roman commander had ever done before. He marched on Constantinople. The proud boast of the Christian Empire, that for centuries no emperor had perished by the hands of either domestic or foreign foes, was trampled brutally into the dirt. Maurice, apprehended in Chalcedon as he sought to escape the Balkan rebels, was beheaded, and his corpse exposed to the jeers of the Hippodrome. His replacement as Caesar, inevitably, was Phocas. 8 years later, the usurper, too, had been overthrown. His genitals were hacked off, his body skinned, and his head paraded through the streets of the capital on a pole. The toxin of something murderous, it appeared, was now well and truly loose in the new Rome. Yet if any man was fitted to the finding of an antidote, then it was, ironically enough, the same faction leader who had toppled Phocas, an Armenian by the name of Heraclius. Handsome, tall, brave, and a born fighter, the new emperor had already more than demonstrated his capabilities by seizing power in the wake of an almost unfeasibly ambitious operation, a naval assault from Carthage, where his father had been governor-general. Certainly, situated as he now was in the eye of a storm as violent as any in all of Rome's long history, Heraclius faced the most searing test imaginable of his many talents. The cracking of the ages that Bahram Chobin had sensed in Iran Shah was increasingly being experienced in Constantinople, too. When crosses in the city began to shake and jump about, few doubted that it portended a truly cosmic evil. In the opinion of Theodore, the empire's most celebrated living saint, and a man of such awesome holiness that he wore a 50-pound metal corset and subsisted entirely on lettuce, the arrival of the devil on earth was near. There will be inroads of many barbarous peoples, and the shedding of much blood, and destruction and captivity throughout the world, and the desolation of holy churches. Then, stated with a terrifying finality, the most shocking forecast of all, the empire itself will fall. Such an eventuality, of course, could only herald the end times, and yet astoundingly, within a mere decade of the ascent of Heraclius to the throne, it had become not merely a possibility, but a terrifying likelihood. The descent of Constantinople into factionalism had not gone unnoted in Ctesiphon. There, eager to escape the shadow of the great Parthian dynasts and to give some colour to his still pallid authority, Khusra II had recognised in the deposition of Maurice the perfect opportunity to busy giddy minds with foreign quarrels. Never before had Iran Shah witnessed such florid mourning for a Caesar. Khusro, despite describing himself as the king who hates war, posed, with a great show of indignant piety, as his murdered benefactor's avenger. As was traditional, he launched his campaign by settling down before the walls of Dara. Abandoned to its fate by the distracted authorities in Constantinople, the great fortress duly surrendered, albeit after a 3-year siege. 3 years after that, in 609, Amida fell too. Then, in 610, the supposedly Christ-protected city of Edessa opened its gates to the Persians. Suddenly, not only Syria, but Anatolia and Palestine lay naked and defenceless before the armies of the Shahanshah. Not since the time of Cyrus had a Persian king been presented with such a deliriously tempting opportunity for westward conquest. Khusro, scarcely believing his luck, decided to go for broke. One army, plundering, slaving, and killing as it went, struck so deep into Anatolia that in